be good or be gone. Be good or be gone.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. Previously, he taught at Boston University and Penn State University, and is the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, Politics After Hope, Obama and the Crisis of Youth, Race and Democracy, and The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, Henry Giroux.
Thanks, Ian. It's good to be here.
And obviously, the teachers in this school in Newton, Connecticut, were heroes. Five of them died trying to protect the students. And yet, as a culture, as a nation, in terms of our political debate, teachers are being vilified. So is this incident, as much as it may wake America up in terms of its insane gun laws, is it possible that America will also wake up in terms of this unnecessary war against teachers?
I'm not optimistic. I mean, it certainly is such a, is an event that is so incomprehensible. I mean, the multiple killings of children, that it certainly should raise some fundamental questions about what it is in the larger culture that allows an event like this to even take place. And also, what is it in this culture that allows the discourse surrounding this event to be so limited, absolutely refusing to deal with larger socioeconomic and political issues at work that may produce these rage murders? I mean, this is a terrible event, but certainly is not new. I mean, I think in 2012, from what I understand, there have been 12 mass murders in the United States. And I guess the real question here is, you know, what is the formative culture at work underlying this kind of violence? I mean, where does it get legitimated, produced, sanctioned, and why is it that we can't talk about these kinds of events except within the narrow discourse of banning or regulating guns?
Well, I'm talking to you from Hollywood, right across the street from our studio is Universal Studios. And a lot of the movies that are being made by Hollywood, and certainly a lot of the television, you just look at the posters. There are people, men, women, actors, movie stars, all pointing guns out at us. So there's no question. And you just look at the new movies that are coming out. The Gay Scientologist, he's got a new movie coming out, all about violence, retribution, revenge. Guns have become the symbol of how men in America settle their problems.
No, it absolutely. I mean, we live in a war culture. You know, it's a culture that celebrates militarism. It's a culture that increasingly celebrates extreme forms of hypermasculinity. It's a culture that wallows in extreme sports. I mean, it's a culture for which violence seems to not only be one of the few mediating forces left that bring people together, but what scares me is that it's one of the few sources we have left that provides what we might call an ultimate form of pleasure. I mean, it's not really simply that it denigrates human beings and reifies them and in a sense puts into motion, you know, the worst kinds of values and social relationships, but it actually becomes one of the few outlets we have left. I mean, there was a story in the New York Times yesterday, a few days ago, about these yuppies, you know, who are now engaging in weekends rather than running marathons. They're sort of wallowing in the mud under electric fences, you know, looking for, you know, the ultimate kind of release in the face of what can only be described as a form of masculinity, that the only thing that they're not doing is carrying a machine gun on their backs, you know.
Well, you know, I've often wondered why it is that as a culture we can't change that notion that's so instilled, particularly in boys and men, that guns are connected to heroism, when in fact guns should be connected to cowardice. You know, I come from a different culture in Australia, and it's always been understood that, you know, men settle, if they have to settle their differences with their fists, that anybody who introduces a gun or a knife is considered an abject coward, and that there's a kind of shame associated with anybody that has a gun or a knife. I know, you know, it's not politically correct to talk about, you know, fisticuffs and settling your problems that way, but it seems to me to be at least less collateral damage than this obsession with guns that have led to these consistent and repetitive massacres.
I mean, it's an interesting analogy and commentary, and I think that, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood as a working class kid where anybody who had a knife or had a gun was completely seen as either completely loony or ultimately a coward as well. I mean, there was no investment in that kind of violence. But I think that what the question begs is what's happened since the 1950s and 60s. I mean, particularly in the United States, to sort of celebrate endlessly the notion that gun is really probably the greatest extension that one can put into play, defining what masculinity is all about and how it should function in a time of crises. I mean, it's everywhere, you know. But I think that at the same time, you know, we have to realize that there's a broader spectrum of violence out there that increasingly legitimates that kind of practice. I mean, I'm worried about a society that shatters all social bonds. You know, I'm worried about a society that, through these market-driven precepts and values, you know, just trades in massive social, political, and economic dislocations. And in doing so, ultimately blames the individual for them. I mean, it has no language of the social. So that whenever the social emerges, the only thing that we can do is disparage it or disdain it. And hence, public institutions, you know, public schools, mental health institutions. I mean, all these institutions now are seen as objects of disparagement. So it's really, couple that with the fact that we teach kids that the best thing they can do to improve their eyesight is to be a first shooter in a video game. And we, you know, we might have to ask ourselves, you know, what is it that allows this culture to allow kids both to believe that to shoot a gun is a great thing, but at the same time is horrified when kids are the object of those shootings? And what is it about the larger culture that allows that to take place?
Now, the reason I called you, Henry, was that you've been writing recently about how corporations are, in fact, waging a war against our teachers, and particularly our public teachers, and there's no question that that is happening. Tie that in to the current situation, then. I suppose that it's pretty obvious that we all ought to be recognizing that the teachers at this school, this elementary school in Connecticut, laid down their lives protecting these children in the way that we expect our soldiers to do. And yet, as a culture, we're allowing corporate America, ALEC, and the Republican Party to vilify teachers and to do everything they can to take away their union rights and downsize them and fire them.
I mean, I think that a couple of things emerge out of that beautifully articulated sentiment. And I think that one is that, of course, what Sandy Hook exhibits is how profoundly important teachers really are and how heroic they are and how brave they are and how crucial they are to public life. I mean, if you want to measure the nature of a society by the way in which it represents and treats its children, the first place you really want to go is to schools. So schools should really be the most important institutions that we have in a society, not the military, but schools. And so the question then emerges, what is it that allows these teachers to be denigrated in ways that are just almost incomprehensible to me? I mean, they're called welfare queens, they're called cheaters, they're moochers, their pensions are being taken away, they're under attack. And I think that what we see happening here is a kind of market-driven fundamentalism coupled with a religious fundamentalism in many respects that just really hates a couple of things. It hates democracy, it hates public values, it hates public goods, it doesn't have a high regard for young people. And basically, it would like to turn the society in almost all of its institutions over to the profit mongers. You know, the same people who gave us the 2008 economic crisis, the same people who basically are laundering money for terrorists. You know, the bankers and these financial crooks, and it's really shocking. And I think that if we don't gain control of what it means for power to be concentrated in relatively few hands in the United States, we are increasingly going to move into an authoritarian society that will basically be governed by a militia, that will basically be governed by the military. I mean, there is no question that democracy is dead in the United States. And I think increasingly the collateral damage of that death is being seen in the victims that we see all around us. You know, from people who are losing their houses, the kids who are being killed, the teachers who are being laid off. And I don't want to establish a false equivalency because there are different degrees of suffering here. But they're all part of the same pattern of abuse and violence that is now both systemic and horrendous.
Well, we know to some extent when you talk about those that are taking over the United States or have perhaps taken over the United States, there are these very malignant oligarchs like the Koch brothers,
right,
who through the American Legislative Exchange Council,
right,
have managed to get these model laws, many of them with the NRA as an adjunct to them. But the last election, many of us thought that the Koch brothers and the oligarchs would have bought it outright, which is what they were trying to do, and the Supreme Court's enabled them to do so. But they weren't able to buy it outright. So do you think there's any possibility of a pushback? Or?
Oh, no, absolutely. I mean, what I'm characterizing here are what I would call dominant trends towards authoritarianism. I mean, but at the same time, you have an Occupy movement, you know, that as fragmented as it is, at least has started a new kind of conversation. You have unions that are beginning to mobilize. You have workers. You have teachers. I mean, resistance is far from dead in the United States. And increasingly, I really do hope that it will grow and become more organized and we'll have larger social movements and third parties, anything to, for the most part, to take party and establish it. Take power and establish it outside of the established range of politics. I mean, I think the United States is on a brink, you know, and I don't think there are any political guarantees about where it'll go. But I certainly think that we are at a turning point in our history. I mean, given the way in which money is being concentrated, given the massive inequality that exists in the United States, and given the sheer arrogance of what I would call ruling groups today, who really, I believe, think they're unaccountable. I mean, this recent scandal, what is it, HBC, what is the bank that...
HSBC, yeah, the British...
I mean, can you imagine not leveling criminal charges against a bank that launders money from terrorists, and yet we'll put somebody in jail for life, you know, who has 2 ounces of grass in them if it's a third strike? It's incomprehensible to me. So I guess what is being learned here about the separation of politics and power? What's being learned is that if you have money, you know, and in power, you're unaccountable. And I think that's going to change. And I think there has to be a massive educational effort, to say the very least, to change the collective consciousness about what a democracy might look like as opposed to what it really is. And maybe the Sandy Hook massacre will do that. Maybe we'll start, we not only will unravel the perniciousness of a gun culture, but we'll start to connect the dots as to, say, you know, give us some sort of broader understanding of where this kind of violence comes from and what it means and how central it is to the culture itself.
And just in closing, though, Henry Giroux, will it end or at least perhaps stall this war against teachers?
I would love to see it end, but it'll simply stall it. I mean, the right wing in the United States, these are religious fundamentalists, the political and religious fundamentalists. I mean, they live in circles of certainty. They don't doubt themselves whatsoever. I don't think the NRA will even budge over this. It may keep quiet for a week, but I think this is a real struggle, and I don't think we should assume whatsoever that this will guarantee the development of a new understanding of what gun violence is about and how it should be stopped. This has to be worked at, meaning that we have to learn from this and then we have to organize in order for this to stop. But I think the last thing we should do is just assume that the nature of the horror has been so over the top that it'll automatically guarantee anything.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Henry Giroux.
Okay, thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Henry Giroux, who's a writer and the current Global Television Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University. He's the author of Youth in a Suspect Society, Democracy or Disposability, Politics After Hope, Obama and the Crisis of Youth, Race and Democracy, and The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking with the author of Rampage, The Social Roots of School Shootings.
It's just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by. And feed them on your dreams. The one they picked, the one you know by.